All right, so moving right along, let's go to item five, and that's going to be our review of the total portfolio performance for the period ending September 30, 2021. I guess that's Q3. So we're going to have presentations from Veris and from our investment staff. And I'm looking to see if Scott has joined us yet. I see Tim is on. There's Scott. I see him coming in.
And I just rejoined as a panelist.
There you are. I hear you. I haven't seen you yet, but I hear you. There he is.
Let me know.
All right.
And
right, so you let me know when you're ready to go, Scott, and we will go with item 5A, which is the total portfolio review from Veris.
I just got a Zoom message that the host has disabled participant screen sharing. So if you could just enable that, please, host, I will share.
You should be able to screen share. Please give it a try.
Yep. It looks like you're screen sharing, Scott. You are also muted when I last saw your cameo in the gallery, so you might want to check that.
Okay.
There you are. Now I can hear you. Okay. Ah, yes, the old email inbox.
Is showing the investment landscape. So is
yeah. You're currently sharing your email inbox screen. So if you have any confidential matters, you might want to drop that.
So my computer says that I'm sharing.
Yeah, well, if you don't believe us, you have Timothy Price, and then you have T Price, it's the Sarah.org. Tim Price. We can read them to you.
Yeah. Let me open them up and then you can really
yeah,
read them.
No.
So,
they're all Sarah. You were doing a search for Sarah, so we're not seeing anything about the other clients, but yeah, you're sharing the wrong screen.
Would you like us to help you go through your incoming?
Yeah.
All right.
It's a good thing all your short sales.
That's because I have no other clients.
Scott, we're going to turn off screen sharing and then pull it up on our side because maybe your internet is having a connection issue. So just give us a minute.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, back to the gallery.
I couldn't help but notice that Scott had 369 unread emails. That
it's a tough room. Oh, yeah. Well, he was just catching up. In fact, we caught him this morning. He was catching up. Jay, I'm sure he's probably halfway through now.
I appreciated the use of numbers to help move things to the top for the alphabetizing your folders in your inbox. Where I can't keep up, so I'm going to move numbers to move the most important stuff to the top, and then they still get out of control, just like my inbox.
Yeah, it's a tough battle, a daily battle.
For a minute, I didn't think Scott was enjoying this dialogue, and now I notice his screen is actually
frozen. He's frozen. Yeah, he's been frozen for a while, so he may be having some technical challenges.
Scott, if you're able to hear me, we are sharing our screen with the presentation on it.
I can hear you, and it seems like every time my status changes, I get kicked out and come back in, and I am muted. So I have unmuted, and I think we are ready to go. So if you wouldn't mind maybe putting it on full screen and then go to slide five, if that's possible.
Not to pile on, but I'm hearing a lot of warbly.
Yeah, you're a little shaky, Scott.
Like bringing it in from the. How about now? I just stopped my video.
Yeah, that's probably a little better. If we can't hear you, if it's not coming through well, I'll holler or Jerry will.
Okay, and then I can always just call in from my phone, and we can master this technology. It may just take a few minutes.
Okay. Well, carry on.
Okay. So slide five. Thank you very much. I'll start here and make a few comments on the economic landscape, and then move to performance. So, you know, this slide shares what really drove markets just by saying that, you know, it remains a story of economic growth and concerns about COVID and what's happening with the progress of the pandemic that continues to wax and wane in terms of impact on markets. Inflation and rates also continue to be a concern and also waxes and wanes. So depending on how the markets view economic growth related to the pandemic and inflation and rates on any given day, you can see a confluence of impact or offsetting impact. And then earnings also has been coming in, and earnings came in strong. So concerns about inflation, concerns about economic growth have been somewhat mitigated by strong earnings that came in. And then this is all sort of wrapped up in the supply chain issues that everybody has been hearing about, and all the ships stuck out at anchor at the ports of Long Beach in Los Angeles, and the cargoes that aren't getting offloaded, and concerns there about inflation and what that may do to economic growth. And then just to add in to the mix, you've got concerns about China and the regulatory crackdown that really came in the beginning of the quarter and had a pretty big impact on international equities, particularly emerging markets through the quarter. So I will take you now to kind of expand on each of those things and ask you to turn to slide 11 and talk a little bit about supply chain disruption. So as of a few days ago, there were 164 ships waiting to unload. And I don't know if you guys have seen the satellite imagery of all the ships at anchor off the Southern California coast. It's an unusual sight, kind of amazing to see. There are 111 ships at anchor off the coast. There are 53 waiting at berths, waiting to unload, but there's nobody to unload them, and there's no trucks to take them where they need to go relative to how it normally works. So our supply chain.
Yeah, you're waning.
Hey, Scott. Pretty lean and a little hiccup.
Yeah, you're at least on my end, you're very warbly. I don't know if others are experiencing that.
I apologize for that. How about if I call in?
Well, let me just quickly ask, is it maybe because sometimes my friends at Comcast, you know, undermine my service. And I don't know if the warblings on my end or someone else's. Are others experiencing that just so that I can get a quick sense? Yeah, I'm getting head nods. So that might be safer, Scott. I hate to discourage you from doing it, but or you know, from staying the course here, but it might be cleaner to call in.
I will do that. Bear with me.
Okay, sure, of course.
And I apologize.
No worries. It's what it is. The challenges in the virtual meeting age, it is, you know.
One thing that
welcome
I can
help. Welcome to Zoom. Enter your meeting ID followed by.
That didn't sound good either.
No, that. No, it didn't, Mike.
I was going to say is when I was leaving Long Beach, heading over to Sackers last week. There were trucks that were four lanes deep for 5 miles. So you can't say that trucks aren't trying to get that stuff out of there. We couldn't even find cars, couldn't even find a lane to drive in.
Was that on the 710?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a horrible road to begin with. But
you have joined the meeting as an attendee and will be muted throughout the meeting.
Hey, Scott, I think you may still be on Zoom and you're echoing. Yeah, or you're muted now. Okay.
Scott, I'll put in a call to Todd and see if he can help us out.
Yeah, Todd, enjoying his retirement, does not want to be disturbed. Well, maybe what we can do, I guess, depending upon what happens here, is we can maybe jump to 5B and do our staff presentation and see if we can sort out the technical difficulties. Tim, what's your thought on that? I don't want to.
We are pulling Scott's phone number into an attendee right now. So
okay.
Bear with me just one moment. We're sorting out the phone number.
That's fine. I don't want to get happy feet about it.
No, we'll get it sorted out quickly here.
Okay, no worries.
So I am dialed in on my phone and waiting to be admitted.
Well, you sound good.
That's my computer. That was problematic before.
Yeah, you sound right there. You sound good.
So Scott, what phone number are you dialing in on so we can pull you in?
714-878.
Okay, thank you.
So,
can you hear me now? There I see you. I see your phone, little phone symbol.
And should be on mute even. Can you hear me on my phone? And
got a pretty good echo going.
Yeah, I think I can manage that. Hold on.
Well, that's one way to manage it, but now I don't hear anything.
For what it's worth, I noticed the city of Walnut Creek had the same problem last night. There was apparently a contentious issue on the agenda, and they had to postpone it until the next meeting because they couldn't get any of the callers in.
I was on a Southern California City Council meeting about a month or so ago, and technically everything went into disrepair, and they just disbanded the meeting and had to continue the entire meeting. Just to,
okay. How are we doing now?
Well, go ahead and try. I thought I heard an echo, so you may. I don't know if you're still on your. I show you on Zoom as well as on phone.
So I muted my computer. I've got you through my speaker on my phone, and I don't hear an echo.
Okay, so I think you're good now. Might want to see if you can boost your volume a little bit, but other than that, you sound clear.
Thank goodness. Thank you for your patience. Again, I apologize. And so
the bad news is, Scott, that's about all the time we have.
Well, that was my plan all along, Gary, so that worked out perfectly. So I heard the comments about the trucking lines on the 110 freeway and trucks trying to get in there to get the goods off of those ships. And just to kind of follow up on the delays. So there's
There's 164 ships, as I mentioned, that are waiting to be offloaded. The wait time is 17 days to get the containers off of those ships, which is about a little bit more than double the normal time. And despite those long truck lines that, you know, that are waiting for the goods, the shipping companies are all complaining about not having enough drivers for their trucks to get the goods out. So it's, you know, it's just a pig slowly moving through a snake, and it seems to be getting caught up at every stage of the supply chain. There's over a million containers on those cargo ships waiting to be unloaded. If you look down at the chart, you can see on the lower right hand side of the page, you can see the impact that small businesses are complaining about these disruptions causing, and you know, no impact is only 10% of the surveyed population. And then significant and moderate makes up well more than half of the population. So small businesses, and I'm sure other businesses, are really feeling this. Moving to the next slide on and talking about inflation a little bit. So naturally, you would expect that type of supply disruption to have some inflationary impacts. The big question is whether it's, you know, air quotes, transitory, or whether it's going to be sort of endemic and be around for a while. You know, we remain of the view that it is transitory. It's the idea that these supply chains, or our research folks remain of that view, and they're continuing to study it and concerned, but they remain of the view that it'll be transitory. Transitory may mean a little bit longer than what was originally estimated. You know, maybe we're talking out now 12 to 18 months instead of 6 to 12 months. And if you look at the chart on the lower right-hand page of this slide, you can see how those monthly price movements peaked in June and then came down through the remainder of the third quarter. Now, interestingly, the October number jumped back up to 0.9. So certainly not out of the woods with respect to inflation. And, you know, personally, so our research folks are of the opinion that it remains transitory, although, you know, they're not as highly convicted in that view as they were. My feelings personally are a little bit different in that, you know, we're seeing big rent increases, we're seeing wage increases. If we get into a wage price inflation spiral that we haven't seen for decades, then expectations will move up as they already are. And once expectations move up, it gets more and more difficult to break that inflationary cycle. So it's definitely a wait and see. And so far, that transitory word keeps getting extended out. You know, I talked about wage inflation, and that has a lot to do with the labor market. If you move to slide 14, you know, unemployment has come way down from a high, I think, of around 15% right after the pandemic broke early in 2020, and we're back down to below 5%. So the unemployment picture improved pretty dramatically and pretty quickly. Certainly much quicker than your traditional recession would have led to. One thing that remains stubbornly low is the labor participation rate. So you can see the chart there in the middle of the page that the participation rate, you know, really came down as one would expect during a recession, and then rebounded pretty quickly, as did the unemployment rate. It showed improvement there, but it's sort of leveled off quite a bit lower than pre-pandemic levels. And what this means is there just aren't as many people out there in the labor force looking for work or working. And the idea is that, you know, a lot of people through the pandemic, flipping to the next page, a lot of people through the pandemic just decided that they were, you know, right around retirement age. They decided that they were in a good enough position that they didn't need to go back to work. And so we may see a permanent reduction in the participation rate, which, again, may have an impact on wages and may have an impact on inflation. You can see on this page here that the different cohorts of the workforce by age.
Scott, I've got it on my iPad here too, but the slides on the screen are not keeping up with your commentary. So whoever is flipping slides.
I'm on slide 15.
Right.
Yeah, we're on 13 on the visual. So.
Yeah, I'll try and do a better job of instructing the driver there. That's my bad as well. So yeah, so went through the labor market and now to the labor participation rate. Thanks for that, Jerry. You can see the age cohorts on the top and the labor participation rate by age cohort. And it's that 55 plus that is below the white line, which represents where it was prior to the pandemic. So, and then you look at down below, you see the retirement impact on that participation rate. And it really, it does seem to be the retirements that's driving it, which implies that it may be a while before it gets back up to pre-pandemic levels. So now switching to slide 18, let's talk a little bit about housing. And you may have been hearing in the financial press lately, just yesterday, there was a survey that came out that showed big increases in rents across many markets and on average, double digits, about 10% increases in rents year over year, which is, you know, pretty remarkable. If you look at the chart on the lower right corner of this page, you can see those upwardly sloping rent lines recently. And of course, rents are a fairly big component of the top line inflation number. So all in all, you know, inflation, it could be that it, and to the housing point as well, some of the developers are coming out and saying, you know, we're not even taking orders now, or we've really slowed down our order taking because we don't have the materials and the labor to produce the houses, and we don't want to miss our delivery deadline. So the supply of housing could be a problem moving through as well. And so, you know, some of these things will work themselves out. Ultimately, they will work themselves out, but it's just a matter of when, how much time it takes, and whether ultimately the inflation becomes sort of endemic in the system. So with that, I want to take you all the way back to slide 23 and talk about rates. So, you know, rates are in the U.S. are really driven by the Fed and how the Fed has been controlling the market on the rate curve on the long end through asset purchases and keeping rates down on the long end, and then setting the discount rate on the short end and keeping rates lower on the short end. So I'll direct your attention to the chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page, and you can see those lower two lines out on the right side of that chart. The red line represents the yield curve as it looked at the beginning of the year. And the blue line represents how it looks now. So you can see at the front end of the curve that represents short rates, short-term interest rates, have remained low, pretty much at zero. The long end of the curve has crept up, and there's a couple of things going on. There's concern that the Fed, if they come to decide that inflation is moving higher than they want to see, they're gonna allow those rates to creep up and not provide so much accommodation, allow those rates to creep up. They don't want to do that because, you know, they feel like that will impact the other part of their mandate, right? Stable and moderate inflation is one, full employment is another, and they feel like if they raise rates, they'll slow the economy and unemployment will become a problem. So they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, it would seem, where even if they begin to grow concerned about inflationary pressures, they they may not have a lot of flexibility to raise rates because of what it'll do to the economy. So all of that, of course, you know, we're interested in how that impacts equity markets and risk markets. And so let's take a look at slide 28 and shift to the earnings picture that I was talking about. So those things that I just mentioned are, you know, all sort of cautionary notes about what could happen to the economy if rising rates or if, you know, growth slows because of COVID. But so far, earnings have been coming in very strong. And so you can see the chart in the middle of the page there, the S&P net profit margins. The light blue is the Q3 forecast. That actually ended up coming in at 12.3%. So if you look at the last three quarters, really strong earnings growth, and the strongest quarters going all the way back to 2008. So strong earnings is supporting equity markets, notwithstanding the headwinds that we've been talking about. And then on the next page, you can look at the valuations, price earnings ratio of the S&P, right? And, you know, I've talked in the past about how high valuations are relative to history, but those have come down a little bit. So you look at the green line there, down at the bottom of that page, and you can see that the valuations have come down, meaning that stocks are less expensive than they have been, and that's really a denominator effect. So the earnings have moved up and been strong, and so that price earnings ratio has come off, and you can see that earnings growth in the orange line. And you know, the question is, will these earnings continue to support high PEs, especially in the face of potentially rising interest rates? So a lot of questions, a lot of moving parts, continues to be around earnings growth and economic strength and what happens with inflation and interest rates. And with that, I will take you all the way to the back of this first deck, to slide 45, to the first section in the book. And I like to end on this slide before opening it up to questions, and talking about what's been going on in the markets across all the different asset classes. And a couple of things to point out here. One is, you know, it was a tough month and a pretty flat quarter. Tough month in September, pretty flat third quarter. You can see a lot of red at the left side of these charts as concerns about inflation and economic growth were sort of driving the narrative in the third quarter. But the interesting thing is, you know, you look at over the longer term, going all the way out to 10 years on that chart on the upper left-hand page, the top line, S&P 500, 16.6%, 10-year averaged annualized. Basis. So the couple of interesting points here is, you know, this is the recovery from the global financial crisis. So we were coming out of a pretty big hole. So very strong recovery and well above much longer term average S&P returns of 9 to 10%. But the interesting thing in my mind is you look at the middle of that chart, the year to date, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year. Still very strong. So it's as if that drawdown because of the global pandemic in early 2020 never even happened, right? You can't even see that in the numbers. And it was such a, you know, it was a sudden and significant drawdown, but a really big snapback, a quick snapback based on fiscal stimulus and increased monetary stimulus. And so the powers that be really did a pretty good job of staving off disaster. The question is, you know, do they just kick the can down the road and will we continue to grow out of it as we have over the last year and a half? A couple of other points on this chart. You look down that same chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page to the style index, and you see the Russell 1000 growth versus the Russell 1000 value in that 10-year column. So growth, even though there's been a little bit of a snapback in value stocks as we came out of the pandemic, growth has continued to outperform over the long term. And that's not what you would expect to see, right? You actually would expect to see a little bit of a value premium over the long term. So that long-term growth outperformance over value is has been a bit of an anomaly. And that has extended, you know, not only in the U.S., but outside the U.S. in international stocks and into emerging markets stocks, although recently the trend has changed, right? You saw developed international and domestic growth outperform value, but because of the China effect, emerging markets, you've seen value outperform growth. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into your performance. And then over on the right side of the page, you can see the fixed income table in the upper right-hand portion. And right in the middle of that page, you can see the under duration, the duration header, you can see the long treasury bond, the Bloomberg U.S. Treasury long. And you can see the impact of rising rates over the past year with the 10.3% one-year return there. And then, you know, the inflationary pressures down in the lower right-hand table, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, long-term underperformance as commodities really struggled over the past 10 years. But you look at that one-year number at 42.3%, and that is reflective of largely higher energy prices, but commodity price rises across the board. And with that, I will pause and see if there are any questions. Hopefully you guys can still hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. So Jerry, did you have a question, or John? I'm sorry.
Now it's just jumped out of, I know what it was. I heard somebody opining, apparently knowledgeably, that one of the reasons that our job numbers look so terrible, so many open jobs without people attempting to take them, is because immigration has been down for the last 4 to 5 years. Any reaction to that, and whether that may change?
You know, John, I have not heard that as a primary driver of so many job openings going unfilled. It's interesting, and I'll ask our research folks about it, but I haven't heard that.
I had neither, and you're confirming my own experience. Thanks.
Any other questions for Scott? I can't see the full gallery, so if you get your hand up, just be patient for a second. I don't see any other hands up, though, however. So no questions being apparent. Scott, please continue.
All right. So I will ask the presenter to move to slide 2 of the next section, which should just be a few pages ahead.
There we are.
Thank you very much. Good driving. So taking a look at the portfolio reconciliation page, you can see, just to give you a review of the last 3 months and the calendar year to date, you can see as relative to your assets, it's really been not a huge impact from investments over the last 3 months, with a net investment change of $168 million. You can see that in the table or the bar chart on the bottom too, as well. And then the net cash flows for the last 3 months, $192 million positive, as contributions have come in. And then looking at a year to date, that net cash flow number gets smoothed out a little bit. And for the full year, you would see, I think, a modest negative number there, as you guys are in a modest net cash outflow position. But looking at the year to date, you can see the significant net investment changes. It's been a pretty strong year of over $1 billion, bringing you to $11.3 billion at the end of the period. Moving to the next page, Louis has a question, it looks like.
Hey, Scott, real quick, on this slide, the net investment change, is that including employees' contributions, or is it just no, investments?
That number would be in the net cash flow number, contributions, benefits, expenses, all the things that that you do to run the plan from a cash flow basis. And the investment change is all about asset price increases and income.
Good, thank you.
And then, so thank you. On slide three, on the left-hand chart, you can see the cumulative cash flows, which is really your, you know, the offsetting investment change, and the green on the bottom is your net cash flow number. And you can see how that, you know, comes in and then slowly goes out over the rest of the year, which is shown in the sort of the zigzag pattern that you see there. And so slightly negative net cash flow. And then you can also see the impact of the drawdown in 2020 at the, with the blue area chart, and then the strong recovery since then, putting you on a continued long-term upward trend, really going all the way back to the global financial crisis recovery that started in 2009. And then the asset allocation history chart, you can see on the right, you know, sort of the spikes that are caused by the cash inflow and overlay as you get market exposure on that cash as it comes in, and then pretty stable asset allocation really since you put FFP in place. Moving to the next slide, this story here is about continuing to move towards your long-term targets. And you can see your current relative to your long-term policy in the bar charts on the left. And then in the tables on the right, your current target in the lower right-hand, or the lower table, allocation versus current targets, your current target now looks a lot like your long-term target. So you are nearing your long-term functionally focused portfolio target. And by the end of the year, you can see your current allocation relative to both current and long-term targets. By the end of your fiscal year, you should be on top of your current targets, which will be very close to your long-term targets as your functionally focused portfolio is getting very nearly fully implemented. Moving to the next slide, let's go into performance a little bit. So this is net of fee performance. And you can see here the quarter to date, the total fund about 70 basis points under the policy index. If you go to your calendar year date and your 1 year numbers, you can see that you're pretty much right on top of your policy index. And then moving back to the quarter, the 70 basis points was really driven by the growth portfolio, specifically in international equity. And we'll get to that in a moment. And we'll see that even though you fell in your growth portfolio, it was largely driven by your emerging market managers and offset by really phenomenal returns in your private markets portfolio. We'll also see that your private markets portfolio and the allocation there relative to peers drove strong performance relative to peers for the quarter. And then you look at your diversifying and your liquidity portfolios, and you can see sort of right on top of the benchmarks there. Taking a look at the next slide, this attribution. So I like to show this slide and have you all get sort of an intuitive sense of it as it shows, you know, really where the performance comes from relative to the benchmark across a couple of different lenses. One is the allocation effect. That is, are you over or underweight your different target allocations? And if you're, say, overweight, a high performing asset class, you'll show good allocation effect, positive allocation effect. If you're underweight, you'll a good asset class, you'll show negative allocation effect. And then the selection is really how your managers are doing against their benchmarks. And so you could see everybody, you know, was really fairly neutral with some slight positive and some slight negative. You can see around that zero percentage line, but fairly neutral. Except for international equity, and we'll go into that a little bit further and explain that. And even that, right, there's a little bit of a scale impact here. Just visually, you can see that the international equity performance impact from allocation and selection was only about 40 basis points for the quarter. I want to move to the next slide and spend a little bit of time here.
Hey, Scott, let me interrupt you. Mike Sloan has a question for you.
Please, Mike.
Yeah, Scott, just quickly, can you explain to me the difference between global equity and international equity?
Yeah, so you have allocations to both asset classes, international being everybody except the U.S., so developed international like Europe and Japan, developed countries in Asia, and then you also in international have an emerging markets allocation, dedicated emerging markets allocation. And then global is you have a couple of managers that can go anywhere. So they can decide if they like the US a little bit better than they like Europe, for example, and overweight the US with a global mandate. They just have that additional lever to pull. Okay, so moving to slide 7. So you've got a number of different indicators here looking at the portfolio. The charts show risk and return, and this is relative to your peers, right? So for looking at this universe of peers, it's public funds greater than $1 billion in assets, and there's 85 of them that are shown here for comparative purposes. And so you can see your index, which is the black diamond on these two charts, the two charts represent 3 years and 5 years. So, and they're pretty similar, but let's just focus on the 3 year numbers. The black diamond represents your policy index, and then the red box represents the total fund. And all the little blue dots are your peers. The where the lines cross, that's the median peer for risk and the median peer for return. And so what you can see here is that you guys remain below your peers from a risk perspective. And from a policy perspective, your policy index is sort of right on that median. So really quite a bit lower risk, but returns that are very similar to your peers. And so what that says is you've got a very efficient portfolio structure, right? You're getting good median-like returns with quite a bit less risk. And as you've seen, that really helps you in down markets. Your ranking relative to peers just shoots through the roof in down markets. You can also see that in the Sharpe ratio number across the top there towards the right-hand side of those, that row of numbers at 1.04, which is a really strong Sharpe ratio. You know, I think of sort of 0.6 as what a typical peer Sharpe ratio might be, you know, a pretty reasonable Sharpe ratio. So notwithstanding any questions there, I'll take you to slide 8 and kind of drill down into performance a little bit before concluding my remarks and opening it up to questions. So this, you know, we've got a few pages that are sort of eye charts here with respect to numbers. But let me make a couple of points and draw your attention to a couple of areas. So in domestic equity within the growth portfolio, you can see there you have negative 0.4 versus negative 0.1. So 30 basis points below your domestic equity benchmark. You have your couple of large cap managers in Jackson Square and Boston Partners have more in assets than Emerald Advisors and Ceradex, your smaller cap managers. You can see your small cap managers outperform pretty significantly. Emerald was 430 basis points ahead of their benchmark. Ceradex was 380 basis points ahead of their benchmarks. And then your large cap managers just underperformed slightly, but because of their greater assets, they outweighed your small cap manager outperformance. And, you know, it's not like these managers are performing outside of expectations, right? They both of them had some selection issues, some stock selection issues in information technology and Boston Partners, you know, had some selection issues in a couple of other sectors, but nothing outside the realm of expectations for sure. So nothing to be concerned with there. Moving to the next slide, international equity. So you can see some underperformance there. And so that includes, as we just talked about with Mike, that includes your international developed in Pierford. Actually, that, you know, they're primarily developed, but also some emerging markets in those portfolios. And William Blair, so Pierford is your value manager, William Blair is your growth manager. So both of those managers outperformed. And then you've got your emerging markets manager there, a couple of managers in PIMCO and TT, emerging markets. And so PIMCO also outperformed. TT underperformed pretty significantly. And you can see, you know, you've got pretty heavy allocations to emerging markets. And when you compare the performance of emerging markets relative to your international developed managers, you can see the benchmark performance there was negative 8.1%. So emerging markets got hit pretty hard. You have a pretty heavy allocation to emerging markets, trying to get that longer term outperformance. And then you had an underperformance even in your emerging markets by one of your managers, TT. And, you know, as I was looking at this and reviewing this and trying to dig into what was really driving that underperformance, I expected it would be a China story, right? China has been hit really hard. In fact, if you look at the CSI 300, the sort of big China stocks relative to the S&P on a year-to-date basis, the S&P has done 25%. China has fallen 6%. The last month, China has fallen about 1%, while the S&P has been up about 5%. So emerging markets has been driven in large part by performance in China. And, you know, we can talk about the China story to whatever extent you want, but I thought that TT would be, you know, a big part of that story. But interestingly, if you look at TT's allocations by country relative to the benchmark, China is their biggest underweight. So it's not an allocation to China. They did have exposure to a property management company, which got, you know, hit pretty hard in the quarter due to the Evergrande story, which was the big developer that the regulators cracked down on. And, you know, that was in the press and the headlines and was a big driver of China performance. But this one property management company that they're in, you know, they're sticking to their guns. They think that the bad news is out. They think that the cash flow numbers and the profit margin numbers for this company are strong. And they think that even in the worst case, you know, they could sell it at a reasonable valuation. So they are sticking to their guns on that. And then the other thing that drove TT performance was a stake that they have in a Brazilian consumer products company where the growth was good, but the earnings numbers came out in line with expectations, but the growth relative to peers was off. And so it got hit pretty hard as well. And they're sticking to their guns on that one too. And they actually expect it to turn around pretty quickly. And they're seeing progress already in the fourth quarter. So Scott,
let me jump in and ask you a question on the TT report. Because emerging markets have been an enigma to me for several years, and I can't quite figure out the allure and the play. But what do we think about their thought about, you know, doubling down, and they and you know, and they're bullish on the strategy when they underperformed that badly, and you pointed out that China wasn't the cause based on the underweight position. I mean, what do we think of their thought about their outlook? Because I wonder.
So a couple of clarifying points there, right? So you use the term term doubling down and they're sticking to their guns, right? So they're not, yeah, well, they're not buying.
I couldn't remember what you said. I should have used your phrase, yeah, and not mine. Yes, they're sticking to their guns. No,
that's fair. Just a point of clarification there. And then also, I would have thought that it would have been an overweight to China, right? But they don't have an overweight to the country. They did have the position that got hurt pretty hard in, the downdraft of Evergrande when the Chinese government came in and basically cracked down on what they viewed as overlevered property development companies. And so this stock that they're in, it's called A Living Services, is actually it's a related service. It's in the property management business, and it got caught up in that downdraft, but they like the fundamentals. And so, it's hard for me to comment on individual stock decisions because we don't have the benefit of the analysis that they've done. That's just not what we do. And so we watch the decisions that they make, and we see how those decisions play out over time. And we see if they're making the right ones, they're making the right calls over time. And so at this point, we're just taking a wait and see approach and on both that A Living Services and on the Brazilian retail by the name of Americanas.
Okay. Well, I mean, just given that others seem to have done better, in the same allocation of emerging markets. I mean, I guess I assume we're going to kind of see how they do relative to their sticking to their guns. Because I've got this visual of the captain in the crow's nest, that, wondering if the iceberg is something that you can pass by. I just don't have a sense often of what drives these things. But anyway, yeah. Enough said. Jerry Holcomb has a question too. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, so, Scott, I got... I'm sorry. Okay.
So, Jerry, before you go, I'd just like to make one quick point about TT. If you look at their historical performance, right, they've done pretty well for you guys. If you look at the one-year and the three-year numbers, they're well above their benchmark and rank well amongst peers. So no real long-term issues here, but certainly as we do with all your managers, keeping an eye on. Sorry, Jerry.
Yeah, so what have you done for me lately, world? It's easy to get caught up in that, but okay, fair enough. Jerry.
For years, they may still exist. There were a lot of funds that were available out there to try and avoid the Japanese quagmire or stalemate, and the so-called ex-Japan international funds. Are there ex-China international funds? Because if there are, I'm beginning to get interested.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's interesting that you say that. So over the trend over the past several years has been to actually do a dedicated sleeve just for China, right? China A shares is the sleeve that folks have set aside, a dedicated sleeve to China. And that really served them well up until just recently when China has underperformed. And I don't know if this is part of your concern, Jerry, but the pain that has been caused in the Chinese stock market has really been self-inflicted by the regulators, coming in and putting the brakes on tech stocks, and then also coming in really from a risk perspective and trying to manage the risk that they saw developing in the real estate market. But property development makes up 30% of Chinese GDP, and so the regulators said, we see this getting a little frothy, and we're going to come in and put the brakes on it, which is what caused the Evergrande thing and the most recent downturn. So I guess that's a long-winded way of not even answering your question. I'm not aware of non-China emerging market funds. They're probably out there. We would have to take a look and see if they're high quality managers. Alternatively, you could likely put together an index fund, right? through a separate account index fund manager that just doesn't have China in the allocation in the lineup.
I guess the concern I have is that it's such a command and control society. And there's just the numbers that come out. I just, it's mostly subjective on my part, but I don't believe a single number that comes out of China. And, you know, I was reminded again of this presentation I went to, and where it was a very good speaker. And he said that I asked him about provincial numbers that seemed to be suspect. And he said, basically, not to worry, because when they get to Beijing, they roll up into a more credible number. Mm. I thought that was an extraordinary answer. It was sort of like garbage in, garbage out. We'll straighten it out for you. So I just, it's a confidence level that I have in China. Even when the numbers are good, I have some concern about whether or not we're going to be able to repatriate any of the earnings that we have, because there's some concern about that as well. So I'm just curious about whether or not there's any noodling around about ex-China funds, because I think it might be worth looking into. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So those were really the comments I had on your equity portfolio. And then, you know, the rest of your portfolio, the rest of the growth portfolio, you can look on the next slide and see how private equity really drove the performance, or really helped out the performance. You look at the private equity numbers relative to the public markets benchmarks, and it was really an extraordinary period for private equity. You can see the really strong returns there. And then, you know, even looking at risk parity, which has been an area that I know staff has been paying close attention to, it has sort of turned around and met expectations or exceeded expectations even a little bit. And then with respect to your diversifying portfolio and portfolios and your liquidity portfolios, you know, certainly in line with expectations there, not a lot to report in terms of areas of interest. You have your new and your diversifying portfolio on slide 11, you at the bottom of the diversifying part of the chart there, you see the SIT, your new SIT allocation that was gone over in detail at the last meeting, has been funded and is outperforming out of the gate, which we always like to see. And then in your liquidity portfolio, you know, again, things moving as expected there. SIT in that case underperformed slightly, and it was largely due to some agency mortgages, the valuation change there, and largely due to earlier than expected prepayments. So with that, I will conclude my prepared comments and see if there are any questions. But overall, a good quarter in line with expectations.
All right. Thank you, Scott. And let's see. I'm just flipping through the gallery here. Are there other questions or comments for Scott? Well, you must have answered the mail. I don't see any, Scott. So that's good news. Thank you for the presentation. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time.
I look forward to that as well. And thank you for your patience at the beginning of the presentation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. It's the virtual age, man. It's technology. It doesn't always work the way we want it to. All right, so let's move from that to 5B. And I'm looking for Mr. Price. There he is. Looking for Tim Price on my gallery. There you are. 5B. So investment performance staff report.
Let me go ahead and share my screen. Just do a quick quality control check. Can everybody see memo?
Sure, we can. Right. Thank you.
All right. So thank you for the time today. This is going to be a brief overview of the portfolio from the CIO perspective. Again, this is complementary to the deep dive that Verus provides to the board every quarter. We go through and just say, basically, are we being rewarded for the complexity that we have in the portfolio? And if had we implemented more simply, would that have met our goals better? So we go through and compare each one of the functional sub-portfolios to a simple benchmark, measure some efficiency, measure some goals over various timeframes, and kind of give the report card from another lens here. I will say just up front, given the portfolio's overall risk profile that the board has adopted being a lower risk, lower volatility portfolio, you know, by that nature, we are set up for defense. So whenever we see a quarter where there's some difficulties, particularly in the equity market, which is the dominant risk in our portfolio and in all portfolios similarly situated, whenever there's a difficult equity period, which there was in the third quarter, not bad, but you know, choppy. We should expect to hold up better in those periods relative to peers. And when markets are really, really trending as they have over the past 5 years or so, we should expect to lag a bit, but still meet our own goals in those particular environments. And that's largely what we see in the observed in the report here for the observations in the third quarter. Let me take you to page 3 of the memo. And let's do the point-by-point report card here. The liquidity portfolio, again, as always, high quality, short duration. It has the number of months that we expect invested in this portfolio. We have shrunk it down from 4 years of benefit payments to 3 years. That was achieved earlier this year. Everything's meeting expectations in that portfolio. Not a lot of yield or price movement going on in the short end of the curve. So we're seeing largely zero returns in the short period here. But over the observed period of we've had liquidity in place for 5-ish years now, about a 3% return. So, that's about what we expect for short duration fixed income. It's not there to be return generative. It's there to be largely the anchor to windward and to provide a lot of certainty around short-term benefit payments. Turning to the growth portfolio, I think from an absolute return perspective, we've seen a 5-year return of 11.7%, so meeting our expectations there. We do measure this over 5 years relative to a global equity index, and we're about 1.5% behind that global equity index. Now, that's a gap that's been around for a little while, but we're starting to close. A lot of that really came from the equity, from the global equity markets having just an incredible recovery, from really April of 2020 forwards until recently, and having that explosive growth. And, a lot of our growth portfolio is in private markets, which lagged a bit there. Now we're starting to see that those private markets, as the valuation cycle comes through, you start to see that private equity number. I mean, we're up 60% in that portfolio over the past year. So that gap is closing there. And as Scott mentioned, from a capital efficiency standpoint, Sharpe ratio within the growth sub portfolio of 1 relative to that global equity benchmark of 0.7 over the last 5 years, we're still getting the efficient returns that we're looking for there. And this is 3/4 of the portfolio at this point, the growth is. So this is the dominant risk that we're tracking. From a risk diversifying standpoint, we went over the portfolio in kind of a deep dive about a month ago, but just correlation running a little bit higher than we'd like to see. We did do a pro forma of, with all the changes we've made over the past year and a half in the portfolio, we do expect that number to be trending down, and we have seen that trending down. This is over a 5-year period. The pro forma is more like a 0.5 there. Positive real returns, while returns have improved within the risk diversifying portfolio, inflation has also spiked. And so we're measuring returns net of inflation here. This is a little bit of a tough piece. We are getting better returns out of the portfolio, but inflation is spiking at the same time. So it's masking some of that absolute improvement there, but we're not getting the net of inflation improvement that we were hoping for. So we're a little bit behind expectations there. But the liquidity profile remains strong, and we can liquidate in really about 30 days there to redeploy. Jerry, you had a question.
Yeah, the report card, if you will, the I guess for lack of a better word, the dashboard has its limitations because it's, you know, it's not particularly granular. But it does show the trend which you've just spoken to. And I'm wondering whether or not you actually anticipate ever seeing, or let's make it 4 or 5 years, that the risk diversification status will move to a meeting expectations.
Yeah, that's a fair question. It's been a difficult area there. I would say that relative to our long-term inflation expectations, yeah, we have seen that improving trend there. I think the managers that we've got brought into the lineup have brought benefit to that portfolio. The research pipeline continues to look for at least one additional strategy that we hope to fund in the next 6 months or so. But this spike up in inflation is difficult here. So I think that is, you know, a question we have to ask ourselves, whether that, you know, whether measuring against a real return is appropriate here, or whether we want to say, you know, does this need to have an absolute return target and be able to redeploy there? I'm not trying to make excuses, but I mean, this is a difficult environment to measure, you know, net of inflation numbers against. I'd say the next couple of strategies we're looking to bring into the equation tend to be things that have a more, I'd say, more direct response to shorter term moves in the market. And so I think largely what we've had in the portfolio are things that are meant to respond to a sustained downturn in the equity markets, a GFC type era, where for 6 months or 3 to 6 months, we're seeing a more traditional recession start to develop and see it get priced into the market and have some ability to respond to it. The things that we're looking at now are meant to be complement that, to see, you know, hey, you know, when we have a sharp downturn, do we have a tool that can respond to that market environment there? And so how those respond to inflationary components, we're still underwriting that. I don't have an answer for you yet, but I think that's something we do have to take a look at here, is say, you know, the docile 2% inflation regime may not be with us over the next 5 years or so. Do we have a tool set that's going to work in that environment as well?
Yeah, I just, if this is a dashboard, I just don't want it to be one of those dashboards where the yellow light is flashing.
Yeah.
For the last 5 years that you own the car and you hope that it'll go out before you sell it. it's of concern if this is some sort of an indicator for us. And seems to me this is dragging the portfolio down, and we don't want to continue to ride a horse that needs a mixing metaphors. We don't want to continue to ride in a car that's got a cautionary light going on. And using the term of the day, I guess, transitory. If transitory becomes 5 to 10 years, then we're talking about life. You know, life is transitory too. And eventually we're all going to check out of that too.
That's so heavy, Jerry. That's heavy.
Yes, right. So I'm concerned about it. And I just want to make sure that this is a useful tool for us.
Yeah.
And make sure that we continue to not ignore, but, you know, place appropriate emphasis on this below expectations transitory issue.
Yeah. And part of it is we're measuring the past 5 years here. So the changes we've made over the past year and a half are obviously a minority of that 5 year period. And so maybe we can add something here that provides more of a short-term supplement to say, like, hey, here's the past 5 years, and here's kind of a shorter term indicator that says trending up or trending down. Maybe we can add something in there to give you a little bit more granularity. Okay, so let's move to slide 4. We'll take each one of the sub portfolios in turn here. Again, liquidity sub portfolio, we really don't have any material concerns. It is a low returning portion of the portfolio. Those 1 year returns coming in at sub 1%. That's about what we expect in this type of yield environment. Each one of the three firms, although their relative weights got shuffled earlier this year when we redid the asset allocation, each one of the three firms still showing good asset growth, asset growth in the product and at the firm level, no regulatory issues, high quality, low duration across all fronts here. And we have shrunk this down to the new three-year target. So that was part of the process of increasing overall portfolio risk by decreasing the liquidity sub-portfolio. If we move to slides or pages 5 and 6 on the growth sub-portfolio, again, a lot of green here from, you know, just stability of the organizations. We note the decline in Jackson Square. This we've highlighted this in the past quarters. They lost a sub-advisory relationship with Vanguard, so that's really driving those negatives there. Everybody else largely kind of in that green category. Adelante lost a bit in the product over the past year, although they had strong returns. And AQR, firm-wide, being a quantitatively oriented firm that had a couple of hiccups in 2019 and 2020, has lost some assets there, but nothing we would highlight as red flags at this point. And then page...
So one more time, if I could, please, on this one.
Yes.
If I read this right, the one-year firm asset growth suggests that Jackson Square is hemorrhaging. hemorrhaging clients or assets or both. So is this something that is slowing or is it accelerating?
This was a one-time event largely. So they lost a very, very large sub-advisory relationship with Vanguard. And so that I'd have to go back and look and see how large it was, but it was a multi-billion dollar relationship. So that one hit earlier this year really shows up in those one-year numbers.
Okay, it's another dashboard thing we obviously need to watch, and you're doing it. Thank you.
Yeah. So on page 6, we'll take a look at the performance for each one of the components here. Again, largely green across the board here. Domestic equity has had a tremendous snapback. Our total domestic equity up 36% over the past year and up 16% over the 5 and 10 year periods. When we look at that relative to expectations, the lag in Jackson Square is putting them behind where we would expect them to be. Some of this, it comes down to their quality bias and not holding some of the large cap tech stocks that have really dominated the Russell 1000 growth index. We take a look at large cap growth and it kind of comes down to the tail of Tesla. If you held Tesla, you outperformed. If you didn't held Tesla, you probably underperformed. Now, the story is broader than one stock, but that one stock is having a really large impact on that segment of the market, and they don't own it. You kind of couple on, did you hold NVIDIA or not? NVIDIA producing a lot of the chips for these cars and for augmented reality and that sort of thing. It's a fairly narrowly led space of the market. We think it fits the story. We're kind of taking a step back and saying, is this quality bias what we need in the portfolio on a prospective basis and doing some work around that. Similarly with Ceradex, they have a strong requirement that all the portfolio companies be dividend producing. Given how dividends have kind of waned in prevalence across the US equity market, we're kind of scratching our heads and saying, does that continue to make sense to have that restriction or a strategy that has that type of restriction in place? But that research project should be wrapped up, probably early in the first quarter, and would make any proposed changes at that point in time. If we look over to international equity, everybody, while the absolute numbers are lower, the U.S. equity market has been kind of the dominant driver of global equity returns. The absolute numbers are lower, but everybody is in line with expectations. Scott highlighted TT's concern or difficulties over the past quarter. You still see a 27% return over the past year. And I think they've added something like 230 basis points of excess return since inception. So while more volatile, the long-term numbers continue to look good there. The only other firm I would highlight here would be Allianz. And Allianz, I think is our high yield manager. This continues to be a parking place for some of the assets intended to flow into private credit. We've highlighted this as the best public market proxy. We would say that relative to, you know, the broader indices, they're lagging a bit. They do have a up in quality focus. When you have a period like last year where everything runs up and the lowest quality runs up the most, they do lag. But they've had some other hiccups in their past as well. So we continue to take a look at that one, but we are drawing it down fairly quickly at this point in time. And then you see the private equity 60% return, which has really brought up all those long-term numbers where we'd highlighted that the extreme underperformance of private markets in general and private equity in particular relative to public markets, that the valuation cycle has caught up, and now we're seeing those strong returns showing up in the private equity book. And I know we're going to touch on that later in the meeting, so I'm not going to dwell on that here.
Hey, Tim.
Yes.
Real quick on private equity, in Scott's presentation, that looked like it was gross of fees. What you're showing here, is this net of fees or gross of fees?
Everything in this report is net of fees. Yeah. And private equity funds are pretty much always reported net of fees.
And on private equity, as it is expanded for us and others dramatically, do you have any concerns about valuation?
We certainly have concerns about valuation in kind of late stage venture capital space, which we are largely not exposed. I mean, we have a very modest exposure to that. I think we'd seen on the buyout side, we'd seen the valuations come back a bit. I know they've expanded again. I'd say it's an area of concern, and this is why we want to be very focused in how we deploy private equity. We've gone from a model that primarily used fund of funds to get broad, diversified exposure to a model where we're out there picking best in class and trying to partner with the firms that we think are have the most discipline, who have been through market cycles, who have stable teams, and who are have the ability to add value even in an called a stretched valuation environment. So I'd say, private equity writ large, yeah, it's a concern. And that's why we're trying to be more focused in what we're doing on a prospective basis. Let's turn to page 9, if we can. Just on risk diversifying. Acadian was added in early 2020. SIT was added earlier this year. Parametric and AFL-CIO shrinking in terms of relative weights here. So I'd say on a pro forma basis, kind of given the restructured lineup here, we're in a better position. You see those trailing 1 year correlations to growth have really come down dramatically. Relative to that 0.8 we see over 5 years, we're getting those numbers down quite a lot there. And I'd say this is on a better path, but and maybe Jerry, this does address kind of the shorter term directionality, but we can add a total risk diversifying performance line in here as well that can address kind of where the portfolio is going over a shorter time period here. So you can start to see kind of rather than just fixated on the big blocky period of time, we can start to get some more granularity in here. Put it all together, and if we go to slide 10, we see the upside downside capture ratio. Still maintaining that spread or capturing more of the upside, less of the downside. That spread had come in quite a bit. Now we see expanding back out. That's what we want to see there. And then, there we go. We take a look at the attribution for the total fund. Most of the segments working in our favor over the short period of time, over the quarter up at the top there. So we did outperform relative to the MSCI ACWI in growth over the quarter. We outperformed in risk diversifying, and we slightly underperformed in liquidity to a modest degree, but we added about 2.5% relative to the simple target index over the third quarter. we take a look at rolling longer term periods here, 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, continue to have superior Sharpe ratios relative to that simple target index, largely driven by a lower volatility than a simple index, and close to simple target index returns. Beat it over the 1 year period, lagged a bit over 3 and 5 years, and beat it over 10 years. So that is the synopsis here. Happy to answer any questions at this point.
Are there other questions for Tim? I know Jerry's had a few, but I'm not seeing any in my side gallery, Tim. So I'm assuming that with regard to your comments and observations in the memo about private equity, that relates in significant part to the proposed staffing changes that we're looking at later on the agenda. Is that fair?
I mean, that's largely coming from the asset allocation increasing and kind of the pacing we've seen. Private equity funds are coming back to market much, much faster than they have historically, and you have a larger target allocation. So to put the money to work, we really need to kind of accelerate some of the turnaround times on the underwriting, and that's going to require more staffing.
Okay. Fair enough. Jerry, you had a question or comment?
Just a quick add, if I could, Tim, if you could provide, unless you have it today, some additional information from Jackson Square regarding whether or not the loss of their assets is entirely related to this one partnership that they had, or have they lost individual clients as well that may have contributed to this?
Yep.
If it's the one-off thing, you know, I guess I get it. If they're also losing clients, then it's a different issue.
Fair point. I'll follow up with that information.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. Anybody else? I am not seeing any other hands up, Tim. So thank you. Very, very informative memo and presentation. Lots to grasp there.